Now I lay you down to sleep. It's a December morning. My daughter Ruth and I step out of the house where we spent the night here in Wichita, Kansas, my old hometown. Ruth brings a paper sack, and I a fringed leather pouch my mother gave me on the last holiday before she died. I was 16 then, 5 years younger than Ruth is now. It has often pained me that my daughter never knew her grandparents. So I'm glad she can be with me today as we try to draw close to the older generation. We cross the winter lawn and find a sheltered spot behind a willow thicket to screen us from the eyes of our hosts, the parents of a girlhood friend. Not that they would disapprove. I just don't trust myself to explain what we're about to do. Hunkered down on the grass, I open the pouch and take out a large abalone shell. It is full of dry herbs, sweet grass, sage, Kansas red cedar, and a sprinkling of beech leaves from the shrine of Emily Dickinson. Next, a handful of papers, letters from my father. I have selected the heartbreaking ones, holding back a few that date to happier times. Last, I take out an aluminum pie plate, just the right size to hold all of the above. Ruth hands me the contents of the paper sack. Two yellow roses we found at a stand near the airport, and a pair of brown catalpa pods brought from our current home back in Ohio. I assume these are essentially identical to pods from the trees that grow at my first home, a ranch-style house not far up the road from where we are now. As a girl, I used such pods for sword fights. Now I lay them alongside the roses and say, I will fight no more forever. My struggle, whether for love or revenge, is hereby at an end. Ruth sets a match to the herbs. When the flame rises, I feed it the letters. The paper curls and blisters like swatches of black silk under a hot iron. Wind whips the fire until it threatens to overflow the pan. I wish it would flare into a roaring blaze, either warming a gathering of friends and fellow mourners, or raging out of control to destroy all memory of idyllic childhoods. But when Ruth says, "Whoa, it's really burning," my fantasies disperse, leaving gratitude for her presence, my girl, my firstborn. I cover the flame with the abalone shell. We smile to see channels of smoke pour through the line of holes along its side. When all is blackened and reduced, the ash fits perfectly inside the shell. Once these things have cooled, I place them in my leather bag. Now we're ready to get on with the ceremony I've mapped out in my mind for this otherwise unmarked occasion. My plans are contrived, not so much because they lack tradition, as because I've had to invent them from scratch. More than 8 months have passed since my father died. It wasn't feasible for me to come here at that time. There was no funeral. He had outlived or lost touch with nearly everyone he once held dear. But it wasn't the lack of ceremony or absence of relatives that kept me away. Rather, a full agenda of painful and obsessive emotions barred the way, including fear, fury, and hate. Next on our plan for today is an appointment with a man named Mark, who was my father's colleague and last friend. Executor of my father's will, Mark has already informed me by phone that my stepmother enjoys full title to the house my parents built and all its contents. My father excluded me and my brother by name. Nonetheless, Mark has persuaded this woman, who played such a bitter role in my life, to absent herself for a few hours so Ruth and I can visit my old home. At the appointed cafe, Mark says he would have known me anywhere, the green eyes and wavy hair, so like my father's. Mark is probably a few years my junior, in his early 40s. He is so overweight, it pains me to see him eat a three-cheese pizza for lunch. His jocular manner doesn't seem to match our conversation. He gives me to understand that assisting my father's widow is his duty, although he does not seem to regard her as a friend. Between chuckles, he reveals that various neighbors have reported overhearing screams coming from my parents' house in recent years. A woman's voice, shrill with anger. It's impossible for me to regard my stepmother as anything but a destructive force. She entered my life when I was 18, not quite 2 years after my mother died, and she convinced me there is more than myth to the fairy tale villainess. Does a biological imperative make her push out the first wife's fledglings in order to claim the man and his property for her own? I have often wondered if an unspoken disappointment poisoned the waters. My stepmother's age was never mentioned, but she appeared at least 10 years younger than my father. She may have hoped for a baby. If so, it fell either to nature or to my father himself, who my mother once confided was a hesitant dad the first time around, to quash her dream. All I know for certain is that my stepmother's tolerance of me collapsed on the sole occasion when I visited their home after my marriage. It was my 9th month of pregnancy. My father sat passive as some deaf Buddha, as I wrote soon after, while she harangued me and my bewildered young husband on the psychological failings of women who crave motherhood. "Don't expect help or babysitting from us," she declared. "I won't play your earth mother game." Over 20 years passed before I heard from my stepmother again. Then, last spring, I recognized her handwriting and the Wichita postmark on an envelope in the mail. Enclosed was a photo of my father, dated 1 month previous. He looked shriveled, spindly as a granddaddy longlegs, staring blankly out a window in his den. Folded with this picture was a newspaper clipping, his obituary, dated the previous week. There was no note or explanation of any kind. Ruth and I soon understand that Mark's main desire in speaking with us is to share a story, outlines of which I'd gleaned over the years, but never the full intrigue. Not long after he cut off communication with my brother and me, our father was dismissed from the law firm where he'd worked for some 30 years. He arrived one morning to find his office emptied, locks changed, fixtures damaged. His senior colleagues all conveniently absent that morning, he was forced to ask a receptionist where he might retrieve his things. For the next 10 years, my father sought legal recourse. He pursued his grievances to the Kansas Supreme Court, a process that broke his health. In the end, he recovered nothing, not the fees pocketed by his partners, not even symbolic satisfaction. Mark says my father was surely a victim of greed, but also that his personality left him vulnerable to betrayal. A lover of the outdoors, of all the trees and birds, as Mark puts it, laughing again. My father liked to hold forth on environmental issues, history and literature, especially his favorite Russian authors. In summary, Mark says, he was a nature boy who forgot to watch his back for wolves. As I see it, while my mother lived, she oversaw their social life and moderated my father's tendency toward self-absorption. Once she was gone, partners at the firm came to regard him as a snob who couldn't be bothered to chat about cars or sports teams. My stepmother was not equipped to provide a moderating influence. She once accused me of trying to humiliate her by bringing a dozen eggs into the house and placing them in the refrigerator. She accused my brother of climbing trees outside her bedroom to peer in the windows and sending threatening letters that mysteriously vanished when their existence was questioned. My father seemed to accept her paranoia as an unavoidable feature of his marriage. Together, they erected barriers no old friend or relation could breach. Choosing isolation, they descended into an all-encompassing folie à deux. Now I realize, after alienating his older associates, how fortunate my father was to find a friend like Mark. A powerless junior member when the ouster occurred, Mark resigned from the firm, started his own business, and shared his office with my father at no cost. Came in every morning to sit and read the paper. His refuge, Mark says, still chuckling. We leave the cafe. Mark drives to the house where I grew up. My head is light, almost spinning. My hands tingle. I imagine if my stepmother were to run late and still be at the house when we arrive, I might fall on her and rip out handfuls of hair, or break into furious shrieks. Some say extremes of self-expression are therapeutic, but I wouldn't want my daughter to witness them. To think that Ruth was in my womb when I last stepped up this walkway and through these doors, I grip my daughter's hand. Mark offers to wait by the fireplace, although it's cold and dark. He says he often sat here and visited after my father was homebound with illness. Ruth and I walk from one end of the house to the other. I won't dwell on the rooms, every nook and cupboard where my brother and I used to hide, every inch familiar as if the very boards should recognize and welcome me. And I see so many of my mother's things absorbed into the current decor. It feels as if she, too, might appear at any moment. Most important to me is a walk outside. Ours was one of the first neighborhoods carved out of farmland on the eastern boundary of Wichita in the early 50s. The onset of sprawl, but we were lucky for it. Our yard is half covered by the shelter belt that edged the former pasture, a triple row of bur oak, juniper, and ponderosa pine. The younger trees were all planted by my father, sweet gum, linden, spruce, crabapple. Ruth carries the things we prepared in the morning. I have a few poems I copied out some days before. Beside the silver maple tree by the driveway, I stop and tell Ruth, this was my favorite climbing tree. I used to sit on the lower branches and sing, used to test how high I could climb and still jump to the ground, knocking my wind out, but never quite breaking a bone. Of course, I imagined, if only I could find the right way to jump, I might take off flying. The maple has changed since those days. It's thicker, of course, but also has a hole big as a wash basin where half the trunk has died and rotted away. My leather pouch holds several small bundles made from rickrack, yarn, and a few strands of my hair. In the hollow of the tree, I drop one of these, recalling how my mother would send us outdoors in the spring to scatter such remnants from her sewing room for the birds to use building nests. I ask Ruth to read the first poem I brought, a sonnet by Edna Millay. Pity me not, because the light of day, at close of day, no longer walks the sky. Pity me not, for beauty's passed away from field and thicket as the year goes by. Pity me not the waning of the moon, nor that the ebbing tide goes out to sea, nor that a man's desire is hushed so soon, and you no longer look with love on me. Pity me that the heart is slow to learn what the swift mind beholds at every turn. Travesty though it may be, in my copy of the poem, I changed Millay's desire to fond wish, lest Ruth imagine there was anything sexual in the rift with my father. Mine was not a case of sexual abuse. We walk on toward the cottonwood tree I used to watch from my bedroom window, tossing her hair against a windy night sky. A tractor tire sandbox sat beneath this tree in my earliest days, later replaced by a jungle gym. Once I saw a green heron raise its neck from a clump of leaves just above my head.
I thought it was a snake. Another time, I learned that a determined possum could squeeze himself into a very small bird box. I read my favorite E.E. Cummings poem. I tell Ruth it was my mother who taught me how it should sound when I couldn't appreciate the jumbled pronouns in my seventh grade reader. For my mother, the poem made perfect sense within the logic of its romantic narrative. Anyone lived in a pretty how town with up so floating many bells down, spring, summer, autumn, winter, he sang his didn't. He danced his did. Children guessed, but only a few, and down they forgot as up they grew. Autumn, winter, spring, summer, that no one loved him more by more. When by now and tree by leaf, she laughed his joy, she cried his grief. Bird by snow and stir by still, anyone's any was all to her. One day, anyone died, I guess, and no one stooped to kiss his face. Busy folk buried them side by side, little by little, and was by was. From there, I lead Ruth north of the house to a huge elm. Amazing that one has survived the ravages of Dutch elm disease. Then again, bare of leaves like it is now, I can't be certain it still lives. But I have no doubt it's the same elm that once held my treehouse, where I slept out with friends, entertained owls, watched foxes prowl below in a flashlight beam, and where I first kissed a boy back in junior high days. The treehouse is gone. A few rusty nails remain where the lower braces propped up the floor. Ruth and I read more poetry, which I couldn't get permission to include in this account. On the elm's gray trunk, in a round knothole, thick, lidded, and white like an elephant's eye, I leave my strands of yarn and hair. Closing our circle, we pause under the walnut trees, sight of the first leaf piles that always brought much joy throughout October. Ruth reads the final section of Whitman's Song of Myself, while I loop the last string of red thread over a bent branch. The spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. He complains of my gab and my loitering. I, too, am not a bit tamed. I, too, am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yap over the roofs of the world. The last scud of day holds back from me. It flings my likeness after the rest, and true as any on the shadowed wilds. It coaxes me to the vapor and the dusk. I depart as air. I shake my white locks at the runaway sun. I effuse my flesh in eddies and drift it in lacy jags. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You shall hardly know who I am or what I mean. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere, waiting for you. Finally, I bring Ruth to a bordered square that was once a garden, currently a tangle of wild vines. Still, the stone paths my parents laid as energetic young homeowners show through the fallen leaves. I have told Ruth how we played all the neighborhood girls throughout the yard, and especially in this garden. How I dressed my dolls in flower caps from the plants my mother grew here. I have shown Ruth photos from those old days, so she can understand where we are. My mother's garden and her grave. The place where my father, brother, and I buried her ashes long years ago. Thorny trunks of dead roses and volunteer trees have been cut low to the ground. Near one of these, we choose our spot. Ruth lays down a rose. I place one across it. The same with our catalpa swords, forming a star. One of the pods has split open since morning, spills seeds among the leaf debris. Around these emblems I walk in a circle and pour the ashes of my father's letters. The letters in which he refused time and again to see me without his wife present, or to be any part of my life other than a silent absence. For some minutes I sit on an old rail-tie bench, survivor in the corner of the garden. It occurs to me we should offer to share the poems with Mark, waiting so patiently by the fireplace. Maybe some reminiscences as well. Ruth and I return to the house and take turns reading the poems again. Mark's jocular manner is gone as he listens with evident attention. His eyes red and pained. He thanks us for the reading. Many other events took place on this trip to my old home, but the only one I will include here is the drive Ruth and I took to the Flint Hills, where my father's ashes were scattered on an old friend's ranch. I have known Evan for many years, and he wrote me at the time to apologize, although he was not at fault, for my stepmother's insistence on excluding my brother and myself from that occasion. Evan leads us on gravel roads to the pasture where my father had asked to join the shadowed wild. We're above the ravine where great blue herons come to nest in the cottonwoods year after year. Evan points out the county road that leads to the farm town of Madison, where my great-grandparents lived and my father loved to visit as a boy. "I thought he'd like that," Evan says, "being on the road to Grandma's." I am struck that he mentions this. In the last letter my father sent, some 2 years before his death, he wrote about his Madison grandparents. This letter I did not reduce to ash, even though it hurt me at first, detached and cold, still rejecting any reconciliation. But as I reread it over the years, I came to see that he was communicating in his way. The letter offered recollections of his childhood I hadn't known before. Summers with Grandma and Grandpa, their prosperous farm a refuge from his parents' Depression-era struggles. It is a windy day. Ruth takes refuge with Evan in his truck while I walk the ridge. Huddled stands of trees in the draws leave the upland bare and stark. The tall grass shivers, gold to russet. I stand and sing a grade school song. Like an eagle flying in the sun, I fly free from sorrow. Like a deer running on the plain, I run to tomorrow. Not to keep Ruth and Evan waiting, I soon turn back toward the truck. That is when I see my father, clear as a cloud in the sky. The way he looked, fit and cheerful, when we used to visit the ranch together, back when I was in high school, when we were close and he was still the perfect dad. He turns to me and smiles, so glad to welcome his girl back after a ramble.